This podcast is a member of the Place to Be Nation family. Visit us at placetobenation.com. The only place to be in your pop culture world.
Come on. We call it the place to be.
Yes, it's the place to be.
Then I shall be.
It is contagious. It is the place to be. And we are live each and every Monday.
Do you actually need a camera for tout, or is it like part of the program?
Yeah, I like Big Dick myself.
Do you listen at all when I speak on the show?
I'm not the one who thrives on whining about carriages that are 3 inches from my fucking car.
So if it's too much for you and your big cock of a walk right to Columbus backpack,
when does it end, JR?
When does it back to the fucking thing? Then what do you want? What do you want?
When does it end?
Making the poor guy making minimum wage while you're sitting there with our mento going to the coffers.
Party people in the place to be.
5 years. 5 years we've been doing podcasts, and we have this. This is trash.
It's not Austin in L.A. It's not Cabana in Chicago. It's not Conrad down in Alabama. Place to Be Nation presents Scott Criscolo and JT Rosero. This is the Place to Be podcast.
Did you worse than Josh Richards?
Place to Be Nation, welcome to the great episode of the one and only Place to Be podcast. I'm your host, Justin Rosero, coming to you live here on this Tuesday evening inside the PTBN studios. My PIC, who normally steps right in right now, is actually tied up at the moment. He'll be joining us very shortly, but we do have a very special guest, as usual. We have a third man in the booth, and that man tonight is cashing in on his episode 500 trivia contest win. This was his prize to join us, and he's actually done this. This will be the second time he's doing this, because he won the previous trivia contest and joined us for a show, and that is the one and only, one of the OGs of Place to Be Nation, that is Ryan Everett. Ryan, how are you?
Pretty good, yeah. I'm cashing in my usual early January spot. I think it's just about 2 years to the date I did it the first time.
Yeah, we looked it up. It's pretty funny, because it was actually came up when I went to message you and Scott. It was like the last thing we had talked about, and it was as a group, and it was January, what is it, was like 10th, I think, 2017.
I
think we had just started the reboot, right? That was like one of the earliest.
Yeah, it was the first Saturday night's main event.
Right, yeah, so pretty cool. Here we are now, wrapping up 88, so it's been a while. So Scott should be in a few minutes. Like I say, he's just running a little late. But I figured we were going to start anyway with some thoughts on the passing of the legendary Mean Gene Okerlund. I had covered a lot of my thoughts on Wrestling Warzone that dropped last week, so I probably won't go very in-depth again. But Ryan, I just wanted to take a minute here, and I'll pause. And did you have anything you want to share, just kind of any memories or thoughts on the legacy of Gene?
Yeah, I mean, he was, you know, I started watching in 90, so he was always, you know, superstars challenged with all the live events and the promos. He was like the guy that really introduced me to the show, and really, you know, those early superstars, they were like, you know, he'd introduce all the guys that you didn't know before, and mm-hmm. kind of the gateway into getting into it.
Yeah, and he really was just a really strong promoter, you know, like a real strong barker for everything.
Right. Yeah.
Whether it was Angle, shows, the hotline, paper, you know, like whatever it is, he was so strong at selling it. It made you feel like it was something you had to see. I mean, he was, I don't know, would you say, is he the most legitimate voice that they've had, like as far as being believable? Like, I think Jesse, like we always talk about, as being like a legitimate, believable guy. But even then, he's always kind of on the heel side. You know, like he's a little bit of wink, wink with him. But is Gene like the most legit, actual voice in wrestling history, at least modern wrestling history?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, you watch like superstars or the preview shows before pay-per-views and stuff. He made, you know, anyone could make Hogan Warrior sound important, but he made, you know, the Jim Duggan Dino Bravo match
right
sound like, oh man, that's a match I gotta see. It's funny, right now I have SmackDown on, and they're showing, it's actually when they're showing the tribute video for him, and like he just went all out into any goofy crap they gave him. I mean, and made it sound believable.
Oh, for sure. Yeah,
he almost got the gobbledygooker over.
He did. He came close. I don't think anyone else would have came nearly as close as him. I'm curious how many people ordered pay-per-views like 6 weeks in advance because he would tell you to. You know, I think I did at least once or twice. Don't get locked out, you know. And when you think about it, you look back, it's kind of like, what is the, like, could you have gotten locked out? You know, like, how does it actually work?
Yeah.
Like,
but I guess. I know back then you had to actually drive to the cable company and get the box, you know, at least I did. So you had to do it, you know, 2 days in advance. I don't know about 6 weeks, but.
I guess maybe if you're calling, because you couldn't just press the button on your robot back then. You had to at least either go get the box, like you said, or if you happen to have a pay-per-view capable box, you had to call an order. So I guess the thought process is if you call that day, the operators may be busy, you know, because everyone else is calling.
Yeah, everyone's ordering, you know.
Right, yeah. So
Survivor Series.
Don't wait till the last minute. Don't get locked out.
Especially that's on Thanksgiving, you know, they might have less people at the office.
True, that's true. And I always like to, like, the last minute hype. Like the day of, on Superstars of Challenge, you know, we're at the 11th hour. It's tonight.
Yeah,
like how hyped
they'd have like no squash matches. Even it would just be interview after interview and video package after video package.
Right. Yeah. It was. Yeah. I mean, he's one of a kind. Obviously, one of the few guys too from that era that has passed away that has been active. Really. I mean, like he was still doing. I think he was doing like overseas stuff.
Yeah, know? I didn't know that until like it came out the day after they showed like his last footage that he shot. It was like 2 or 3 weeks ago, I think.
He was doing that, and also he was doing the story time, the voiceover for the story time on WWE Network. So I'll have to find someone new to do that. So yeah, he was still pretty active. I mean, he would obviously he's at the Hall of Fame every year. You know, he'd be at all different other events that they'd have going on, Legends stuff. He was in the Legends house, you know, so like he was still fairly active presence on WWE TV. You know, it was a little bit a ways ago now, but of course he also had done, you know, that old school Raw type stuff. They brought him out to do like the podium interviews and he was a talking cat on a lot of video packages. So, it, you know, again, he's someone whose presence that it wasn't just like a legend that's been gone. You know, gone and off TV forever, but he's someone that's been active. Hey, Scott, how are you? Welcome to the show.
Good evening, JR. Good evening, everyone. Sorry for my tardiness. Continue.
Hello.
It's okay. I'm here with my PIC, Ryan Everett, joining us tonight for this special MSG review.
Good luck, Ryan. It's a job you may not want to take, so.
So anyway, Scott, it's good timing because I had given a lot of my thoughts on Gene on Warzone and I gave a few more now. Ryan gave his. Did you want to take a minute to share any thoughts on the passing of Gene Okerlund before we get started?
Well, Mean Gene is an icon. And we were talking, JR, on the board about, you know, what deaths hit you, on our message board, about what wrestling deaths hit you. And I was very blanketed in my comment. I mean, like Owen and Eddie, like those are Pillman. Those are just those stand alone because of the shock of them and the circumstances. Mm-hmm. But any time right now in our lives, regardless of how old you are, seriously, age is irrelevant here. Whenever somebody from the Federation era passes away, it's almost like a little bit of your childhood went with it. Whether it's Dusty, Piper, Savage. Savage probably is at the top of the list because he never got in the Hall. And you feel there's something hanging out in limbo that never got closed. So that one's always going to be tough for me because – and we had it, JR. We did a whole episode on it when he passed away. You know, he's a guy that will always bother us because – or that death because there was never closure. But Mean Gene's just – he was the – I mean, besides Gorilla, Mean Gene was the voice of that era. Every event center. Every interview in the house shows, every interview on Superstars, he was literally on every single thing you put on that was on TV. Mean Gene was on in some capacity, and he was everything for those, you know, 8 years.
Yeah, one of the things we were just talking about is he the most legit voice in pro wrestling history? Like we mentioned Jesse, but he always had the kind of the heel side to it. But is Gene like the most legitimate? Like, you know, we talked about this way back in '85, Scott, with why he was doing the MSG shows, why he did the war to settle the score, because he was such a legitimate, polished voice. Is he the most in wrestling history?
I think so because, I mean, you know, other guys will tell you, you know, like you know, good old Will. Mm-hmm. We'll talk about guys like Lance Russell and, you know, Gordon Soley. But those guys were territory guys.
Right, well, they're legit in a wrestling way.
Right, right. Yeah. Mean Gene was legit because he was the bridge voice from wrestling to, even though the term wasn't really used in the 80s, pop culture. And, you know, MTV, War to Settle the Score, he was known because there were a lot of wrestling fans in the 80s, and he marked it by being on that show and then went from there, went to WrestleMania 1, and the ball was rolling. So as much as there were legendary voices in the wrestling business history, Lance Russell, Gordon Solie, Caudle, Tony. Even Tony Vince. To a certain extent, yeah, Vince obviously. Tony would gain it later on in the decade with when WCW grew. But the first and only voice that bridged so many levels for Jesus, probably 30 years, was Mean Gene. Going back to 70, whenever the hell he started in the AWA, 75 or whatever, probably. Yeah. All the way till he got here in 84. And then he went to W. And then he had to go to W. It was a bummer that he went to WCW, but Vince was changing the demographic in the mid-90s, and Mean Gene, just like some of the others, didn't fit anymore. So at the time, WCW fit him. But I was saying this to somebody today, and you and I have talked about it before, JR, when we did that vault. One of the most emotional – I don't say kayfabe, but one of the most emotional moments for me as a wrestling fan watching something will always be WrestleMania 17 – the gimmick battle royal when Mean Gene and Bobby came down the ramp, because to me they were always WWF guys, always. Mean Gene obviously had a little more energy. I mean, obviously Bobby, a lot of probably towards the tail end of WCW, mailed in a shit ton of nitros, which is pretty evident, and he's admitted it. But Mean Gene towards the end was the face of WCW in terms of the interviews and everything till the end.
Mark Madden.
Yeah, yep. Exactly. Well, he took up a whole fucking camera, but you couldn't avoid him. But when Mean Gene came down the ramp that night at the Astrodome, it was like, all right, I'm okay now. I feel better now. It was weird seeing them far away, you know. So to answer your question, JR, there's no doubt that Mean Gene's voice bridged generations and opened it up nationally to the wider audience. And that's why and that's why the Federation era was such a success all around. Hogan did the work in the ring, and obviously from the talent perspective, it was all Hogan. But in terms of the guy that was literally on every – you could not turn a piece of television on from 84 to 93 that had the WWF logo and not have Mean Gene on. Superstars, oh, yeah. Challenge, All-Star, Primetime. It didn't matter. He was everywhere. And he was you could argue he was the face of the company from a marketing perspective, because Mean Gene was everywhere and everybody knew him. Everybody knew Mean Gene. So it was a tough loss, And obviously we knew he was always sick. Everyone talks about Legends House when when his one arm was a little more swollen than the other. He obviously
a little more. It was like Jason Pierre-Paul's fucking club.
His taped up oven mitt. But
or was it Humanoid? Who had the club? I always get those two mixed up. Who blew the hand off? Was it OC or JPP?
It was JPP.
Okay.
He blew it off. Yeah. And he taped it. Looked like a pickup. Yeah. So obviously he wasn't healthy, and eventually I'm sure the whether it was diabetes or whatever caught up to him. But it's sad because another – and we're doing – and that's what makes it so special, JR, that we're in this stretch right now, because we don't see him as on the house shows as much now as we did. Mooney pretty much – and we'll talk about when we get to those. Mooney pretty much handles the interviews on these house shows now. So we don't see Mean Gene a ton locally anymore. He's obviously mostly on the Cindies, and we'll obviously see him on the pay-per-views. But he'll always be a major part of our childhood. Pretty much is the face of the brand marketing-wise, well before Vince. Vince was just a putz on Prime on Saturday Night's Main Event. But Mean Gene will always be remembered as pretty much the face of the brand, you could argue, in terms of the marketing aspect. Hogan, obviously, the face talent-wise. Mean Gene, the face, of the product. And it's sad. It's sad. Another guy from our childhood gone. To go with Piper, Savage, Dusty. Sad. Obviously, there's others that fortunately still alive. I mean, obviously, you never know when a guy like Hogan goes or whatever. I mean, obviously, Vince is another case altogether, but... these guys aren't getting any younger. It's unfortunate. So rest in peace, Gene Mean. I mean, even Iron Sheik's tweet when he said, say hi to Nikolai for me, that hit me. It really hit me, because he meant it. As much as he's a fucking psychopath.
Right.
You knew, well, you knew what he meant.
His handler or whoever is actually doing it.
Yeah, the guy that does it.
Yeah.
Look, I saw his handler sign things for him. So.
Yeah, he's not doing shit. So, all right. Well, why don't we move on to the night's business? A happy new year. We didn't do that off the top here. It's our first show of 2019, Scott. So
yes.
How many years is that for us? We started in 2011. That's so
February. It'll be eight.
8 years. It's way
eight
too
years.
Long time.
It's a way too long time. That's for sure. So, guys, as you mentioned, we are on 33rd JR back in the office. Been a while, huh? Oh, I guess not.
Yeah, a little bit of time. Yeah.
Yeah, but a month in our timeline. When was the last time we did the house show? God, it seems like a little longer than that. It is December 30th, 1988, from, of course, Madison Square Garden, the final show of the calendar year. And once again, they spread the roster out tonight, guys, because there was not one, not two, but three shows on this day. Two of them were on the same day. One had to have been a matinee. One part of the roster was in Ohio. I'm sure the early one was the Hara Arena in Dayton, which is, I think, where the University of Dayton plays. All I have on there is from our friend Graham Cawthon in the history of WWE.com. Your Intercontinental Champion, the Ultimate Warrior, took on the Honky Tonk Man. That's all he's got. Okay. The other show was actually in Columbus, Ohio, at the Ohio Center. I'm guessing that's where the Buckeyes play. Here's your card. Danny Davis defeated Lanny Poffo. Paul Roma over Conquistador number one. King Haku defeated Jose Estrada, who subbed for Harley Race. We'll talk more about him again, JR, as we get into the new year. The Rockers took on the Brainbusters. We will most definitely see that on our stage soon. Brutus Beefcake defeated Ron Bass. So that feud's still cooking a little bit. Honky Tonk Man defeated Tito Santana. And in the main event, the Ultimate Warrior defeated Akeem. It's an interesting main event, huh?
It's a dream match.
For you, obviously, a dream match. Akeem should have stolen the tassels. Obviously, we're in the big building on the East Coast. The big building in the Midwest for the WWF had a big show, and that, of course, is the Rosemont Horizon, which had 11,000 in suburban Chicago for this show. Let me know what you think. Steve Lombardi pinned Jim Powers. Scott Casey pinned Iron Mike Sharp. Sam Houston over Conquistador number one. Which was, of course, Jose Luis Rivera. The Hart Foundation – how about this one, JR? The Hart Foundation fought the Rougeaus to a draw.
Oh.
Sure, that was a pretty good match.
Yeah.
Your women's champion, Rockin' Robin, pinned Sensational Sherry. Aren't we lucky we didn't get that? Ted DiBiase defeated Hercules after Virgil interfered. Andre the Giant defeated Jake Roberts via DQ. We'll talk more about that feud in the coming shows. And finally, the main event, Hulk Hogan defeated the Big Boss Man via countout. So not a bad show in Chicago.
Yeah.
Except for
I'm
that,
sure Hogan Bossman is good. They've all been good.
Yeah. That Rockin' Robin show was a drizzler. So, what do you think, guys? Before we get to our opener, what do you think, Ryan? Danny Davis, Lanny Poffo, or Steve Lombardi, Jim Powers? Or the opener we're going to have, which we'll talk about in a minute?
I think I'd have to go with the MSG opener. I hate to get it all again in Chicago, but I could sleep on a Steve Lombardi match.
or Cody Parkey versus the crossbar. Your choice.
Yes. Exactly. Yeah. All right, JR, there's your other shows for the evening. Any other tidbits before we begin?
Just one on 1224 Superstars. Brother Love Show had Big John Studd and Bobby Heenan on as special guests. Big John Studd would be making his return to the company. Told Bobby Heenan he wants nothing to do with him. So there you go. Studd is back, and he is eschewing his old manager. We then head inside the garden, where our buddy Rod Trongard and Lord Al Hayes are in the booth to close the year out. They set the stage for the show. Fink introduces the friend of Madison Square Garden, Hillbilly Jim. He comes chugging out to ringside to a nice pop. Jim settles in. He'll be the third man in the booth tonight, taking the departed superstar Billy Graham's place. We talked about Billy at our last one and how we started to kind of enjoy him, but he's gone.
Mm-hmm.
All right, our opener is Red Rooster taking on the enigmatic Blue Blazer. I thought it was a pretty good match on paper, but in the usual openers we get saddled with. Jim talks about the history of MSG. We get some stalling to open up. Rod calls Rooster the Mecca, or he says he calls himself the Mecca of Manhood, which I've not ever heard him say, as Blazer controls the arm early, tossing the Mecca around. We get some shoving until Blazer smacks Rooster and continues to frustrate him. Rooster lands a strike, cranks a headlock on and off. Jim's a bit subdued early here, kind of missing Graham's energy, I thought, out of the gate. Blazer comes back with an atomic drop and a clothesline for two, and then he goes to a side headlock, but the old Mecha Manhood counters with a back suplex. Blazer slowly works through the arm some more and then twists Rooster into a Boston Crab. Rooster forces the rope break, but Blazer stays on top as Jim rambles about Bobby. Rooster hits a neck breaker and finally turns the tide and starts to work the head, getting a near fall. Rooster cuts Blazer down the clothesline, dodges a charge as Blazer hits the post hard. Rooster takes him down with a back suplex for two. Rooster goes to the arm, but Blazer escapes and then whiffs on a cross body. The Mecha gets two there. Rooster pitches Blazer outside in the after the Masked Man gets a close near fall. Rod calls Rooster the cock of the block as Blazer returns to a sunset flip for two. Rooster goes back to the arm. We get some boring chants here. Blazer is able to reverse the hold into a nice German and then dodges a Rooster elbow drop. Blazer gets a hard in Zaguri and then a drop kick off the middle rope for two. Blazer gets a backbreaker for two as the crowd has woken up. Rooster hits the floor after eating a drop kick. Blazer dives to the rope, spears him to the ground. Blazer suplexes Rooster in for two, but Rooster comes back with a hot shot, sets up the Scorpion. Blazer blocks out with an inside cradle, and we get a draw as the bell sounds. Solid match. It heated up late. If this is more like 11 or 12 minutes, I thought it would have popped more if you cut out some of that middle piece. But it's a fine opener. I thought better than usual, for sure. Both guys look solid. And the only thing that really hurt it was them playing to the draw, as you could kind of tell as it edged along. But I get why neither guy, they wanted to lose. Rooster's been getting his ass handed to him anyway. And Blazer's still kind of climbing the ladder. So I went 2.5 on the Scott. Again, better opener than usual. I just wish maybe we'd shaved about 5-6 minutes off.
Did you say Trongard said cock of the walk? Was it Trongard you said?
Cock of
the block. Yeah. I was saying, did Trongard go into the future and steal Aaron George's scripts? Because that's, yes, I think it's been at least two or three Christmas specials, that line. I gave it a 2.5 also. Yeah, it was a fun back and forth, but we didn't – I mean, they could have just made it a 15-minute draw. I mean, who's to say that we have to follow the draw rules, for God's sakes? I mean, you could definitely tell, and I'll alliterate more into this, allude to this more in our second match, but the roster – I know we'll definitely delve more into this as we get into 1989, but you could definitely tell the roster is starting to be more responsible in-ring wise. Vince is finally realizing, all right, the cartoony guys are nice, but I need some actual workers because, you know, promos aren't going to cut it when you got a bunch of slugs in there. And we usually don't get really great openers. We usually get a couple of bums. I mean, I know we're going to get like a filler later in the show, but normally the opener is, as we saw from the opener of the other two shows, Danny Davis and Lanny and fucking Lombardi and Powers. Mm-hmm. Not exactly this match. At least this match, you had really two legit guys. Having said that, I do feel like they held a gear back. This could have been a good 20 minutes. Instead, it could have been a good 14 minutes, but a average 20 minutes, you know? You can clearly tell Blazer has talent. We all know who it is, obviously. But you can tell that he can hang with the Rooster. I don't know if Terry Taylor isn't giving it his all because he didn't get the gimmick that we'll see later in the show, and he's kind of dogging it. Because I expected more out of this match than I did, Ryan. I gave it 2.5 as well. But like JR said, I feel like on paper you felt this really could have been good, and it fell a little short.
Yeah, I thought the same thing. I was looking at it. The results before I watched and I saw, you know, Blue Blazer versus Red Rooster. I was like, oh, that should be, you know, you're not used to seeing two good wrestlers really mm-hmm. paired up on these 88 shows, especially opening the card. But yeah, it was like anytime Rooster, I know it was 20 minute draw, so you got to stretch things out, but just way too much work in the arm. And there was one point he hit like a suplex or something. Got a two count and then went right back to a hammerlock. It's like, no, that's when you kick it up a gear. And then it just, yeah, it really dragged for parts, I thought. And then I thought the ending could have been a little hotter, at least, you know, give the Blazer a high cross body or something to make it look like he was just about to get it right. going. It was just, he blocked the sharpshooter or whatever, the Scorpion that the Rooster was going for, and then like had a weak roll up for two, and it was kind of like the bell rang and that was it. I 2.5 also. It was just kind of, you felt that they could have done better, and it probably would have been better if it was like 15, even 12 minutes, maybe switch it with another match later on that could have opened and bored the crowd.
Yeah, you wonder if they do that finish sometimes so it's not always like the hot thing. I mean, I don't know why you would, but maybe just to add some variance to it, I guess, possibly. Yeah.
I didn't get an exact time, but I know it was right about 20 minutes.
Yeah, usually Graham will put the actual time if it's not exactly 20, and he put 20, so they may have gone right up to the end. Normally, he'll put a time limit draw at, you know,
52.
Yeah, 1907 or something, but he put 20 minutes, so they may have been pretty close. They may have been pretty close. But, yeah, I feel like they did do the different kind of ending, but it's amazing, JR, how – and we, obviously we've all been watching wrestling for so long, but it's funny how we've been watching these house shows now for – and it'll be 4 years, four chronological years, that we can feel a draw coming on, you know?
Right, oh, yeah.
Like
yeah,
at a, sure. You know, like about the 10 or 11-minute mark when you start seeing, like, multiple face – like when you see the big face come back and then it gets cut, you're like, oh.
Right, and back to another headlock or whatever.
Yeah, exactly. So – but, yeah, no, solid match. I wanted to give it 3. I just couldn't. Maybe if the match went 15, I might have given it 3, but they definitely dialed it back the last 5 minutes to kind of set the draw up. So 2.5 for me, too.
All right. Bad News Brown comes to the ring, says the MSG crowd can tell their kids and grandkids that they were here the night he made history as the first New Yorker born and bred will win the Dirty F Championship and then takes a shit on the mat. So good for him. Next up,
before I say something very super quick.
Yeah,
and I said it today. I actually took my – I was looking – Rotella was, you know, at his dad, and I took my buds off. I looked at him. I said, I think that Bad News Brown – and this is not just this promo. I think Bad News Brown pretty much alluded for the whole time when he was having this mini feud with Savage that, like, fucking Savage was, like, whoring Elizabeth out to,
oh, yeah,
to Jack
yeah.
Tunney for, oh, yeah, yeah. for favors.
I mean, favors.
Yeah. I mean, he was – I mean
– he wasn't alluding to it. He was pretty much saying it, yeah.
Okay, good. I want to make sure I wasn't crazy that he was pretty much saying that Elizabeth was his, you know – you know, hey, yeah. So all right.
Okay, no, it's good. A big part of this feud. That
yeah.
Piece of it.
So,
all right, anyway. Our second match is another interesting one, is Mr. Perfect Kurt Hennig. He takes on the Birdman, Coco Beware. Like I said, Perfect still has headache attached to the name. Coco jogs out for a pretty key match here and keeps the show on to a nice start. Perfect remains undefeated, looking to stay hot. Frankie's chilling at ringside as Jim gives some kudos to Perfect for backing up what he says he is. Perfect works the arm a bit as Rod calls the bird. Frankie goes Hollywood. Coco tries to find a seam, but Perfect is staying in control through the arm. Perfect pauses to talk to the crowd, which allows Coco to slug him from behind. Get to work with some forearms and a slam. Coco starts to work the arms out, thinks Perfect's just testing the firepower of Coco. Coco unloads a flurry and sends Perfect flying over the top to the floor, suplexes him back in. Coco stalls a bit, measures Perfect in the corner, comes up empty on a splash. Perfect hammers away, kicks Coco outside and then swats him back down as he tries to get in. Coco ends up draped across the top turnbuckle. Perfect lays in some stiff kicks, knocking Coco up and over the floor. Coco makes it back in, fires away with jabs as Perfect tries to back off. The crowd's all fired up as Coco's mauling Perfect. Coco stops and dances for a minute, and that opening allows Perfect to get his knees up on a splash and gets the Perfect Plex for the win. Al calls Coco for flapping his arms and getting caught, calls him out on it. Real fun match, I thought, with great fire from Coco, good, hard, aggressive offense from Perfect. I wish this one went longer. It was really humming along. Perfect's rolling. Coco's doing his thing. I dug this one. 2.5 as well. And it could have went even higher with a little bit more time. I wish they took 5 off that one, put it on this one. I think we would have got much better balance between the two.
Yeah.
What do you think, Ryan?
Yeah, I would definitely have gone for the switch there. And I think a match like this just kind of further, I mean, I know Pritchard's gone against it on his podcast and stuff and just goes to show you that whether they were thinking about the gimmicks for both at the time, there's no way that, you know, Henning could have been the Red Rooster and Terry Taylor be Mr. Perfect. I mean,
yeah,
Perfect,
yeah.
He's got such control of that character. So, you know, what is this, like 4 months in? And it's just, it's unbelievable how good he was already at this point. And, you know, Coco, to his credit, you know, he hung in there and he got the crowd behind him, especially towards the end when he had Perfect down. And you almost believed that maybe he could be Perfect. But then he, like Trongard said, he flapped his arms too much. And
it was
the beginning of the end. Yeah, I actually went 3 on this. I thought it was really good.
Yeah, I went 2.5 as well, like you, JR. Again, like the first match, you wanted it to go that next, and it just felt just a little short. But now I get to add on to what I was alluding to in the first match. You definitely see from these first two matches that Vince is definitely in the company is definitely adding more athletes to this roster. And we're seeing a lot less, you know, the Moroccos and the JYDs and all these, you know, older, you know, fat slugs that, that just can't cut it anymore. It's one thing to be like Akeem, a big guy on purpose. It's another thing to once be in shape and then just be slow and lazy, which is what the Moroccos and the JYDs turned into. And Vince is definitely realizing that, that, having like one or two in-ring guys is not enough. You need like nine or 10 in-ring guys spread out across all three divisions, you know, main event, mid card, tag. And you're seeing that now. And again, we'll really see it flourish in 1989. Your match time, by the way, 11:42. So maybe if they made the first match 15 minutes and made this match about 15 minutes, I think we'd have been in pretty good shape. Coco definitely held his own. 11:42 was a good length anyway. I thought this match, I when I started watching it before I looked at Graham, I thought this match was only going to be like 6 minutes. But it wasn't. It was they gave him a good amount of time. Perfect. I don't know, JR, do you think that, and Ryan, do you think that, like, he still, like, we talked about this with Rude, and we'll get more into him later, too. They still were kind of in that territory wrestling mode before we really got into, like, the character mode. I mean, obviously, we're like, in between tights. He doesn't have the white and black tights that he wore in AWA, and we don't see the good stuff, you know, what he normally wears for a few months. But he definitely hasn't totally gotten that. Even, and he's been in the WWF before, but hasn't quite hit that gimmick stretch yet. He was still kind of wrestling in that kind of grappling territorial kind of feel before he really settled into the gimmick itself. I don't know if you noticed that. Maybe that's what, and maybe that's what made the match better than it was. Maybe it wouldn't have been as good a few months down the line. But I noticed Perfect was Hennig was not quite in the perfect mode yet. Like, he was still kind of, you know, feeling his way into the character before he really settled into it. Didn't make the match bad, but you could just tell that he wasn't quite at that level he would be at in a few months. Still a great match, though.
Yeah, I think it was.
Yeah, go ahead. I'm sorry, Ryan.
Oh, sorry.
No,
a couple months until they totally, you know, like you said, gets the new tights. And I think by the time he gets the tights, it's all Mr. Perfect only. And I think that kind of, maybe like, and then the promos started right around then, I think. Like the, you know, the famous.
The vignettes, yeah.
Yeah. So I think that's kind of when they maybe was like, okay, he's got his feet wet enough. He knows what he's doing here. Let's actually get behind him and push him.
Yeah, see, I was going to compare him to Rude because it's an interesting one to me. I don't think Perfect's in any kind of different mode. Like, I think he's already been more impressive than Rude was in his initial matches. Like,
yes,
you know, like, he's out there like working at a much better pace. He's controlling the matches. He has more offense. His selling's more important. So I think Rude's getting there finally. We're starting to see it a bit. But I think Perfect has adapted much quicker. Like, maybe character wise is to come, but I don't think he's like behind the, you know, behind in the wrestling at all. So,
and Perfect. I mean, Rude's first started like right away almost with Steamboat and stuff, and Perfect, you know, he's making, I mean, nothing against Coco, but he's no Ricky Steamboat, you know, and he's having, this match was probably better than any of those Rude Steamboat matches from early in 88, I would say.
I would agree.
Yeah, definitely. No, I agree. And I think, obviously, Rude and Perfect are, you know, they're different levels of wrestler as much as, I mean, Rude is great, but he's not perfect. He's not Kurt Hennig in that aspect. But a great match, though. And again, just a good example of how the roster is slowly transitioning. Yeah,
for sure.
So.
All right, speaking of the Ravishing One, Rick Rude comes out now to strip and dance with the ladies. He starts talking shit to everyone, offers up a chance for a Rude Awakening kiss to anyone in the crowd, and a young lady comes in as Rude's all heated up over how excited she is. She's not exactly wearing anything sexy here, though, at all. She's a bit skittish. Rude tries to help her ease her, and but closing his piercing bedroom eyes for her. As he stands there with his eyes closed, Hillbilly gets in the ring and kisses and hugs the woman. Rude opens up and jumps Jim, stomping and beating on him. Jim eventually chases Rude off, and usual Hillbilly Jim December tomfoolery. I feel like every December we're good for some Hillbilly nonsense out here. Rude, I thought, was good, but this stuff does not hold up well. Just from, whatever. stuff that passed in the 80s that shouldn't pass today. Like, it's a bit much watching, you know, Rude coerce this woman and closing his eyes to make it easier for her to kiss him. And then Hibbley comes in and forces a kiss on her. And he's the fan. Like, a lot of it, just, it was a little bit, you know, just doesn't hold up well. But so it's obviously going to trigger some sort of thing, MSG-based angle here between these two.
Yeah, I wonder if I don't know why Hillbilly Jim was even there. Maybe he was supposed to. Maybe he's replacing Billy Graham in the at the table, but it didn't help. I mean, Alfred's doing his best to try to be very, trying to have a little heel to him, and it
yeah,
comes
Billy
out more
wasn't
and more
a heel
as the
either,
show
though.
Progresses. No, I don't know.
It was Billy. It was more that we're missing is Billy's energy. Like, that was one thing I was actually enjoying with him. Like, Al and Gorilla are both. Al and Ron has some energy, but Al's very, like, you know, just kind of straightforward on, you know, on beat. Whereas Graham, like, really would get energized and you know, bring some activity to the booth. And Jim, I think maybe he'll get there eventually because he's not really a monotone guy. But here, I don't know if he was just uncomfortable or nervous, but he's very, like, you know, I'm talking like this, Al, and here comes the bushwhack. You know, it's like it was very not like a Hillbilly Jim. So we'll see if he did.
Yeah, it was really subdued for the cartoon character of Hillbilly Jim, I thought.
Right.
Especially that first match, you know, 20-minute match, and he was just slowly talking about how Bobby Heenan's ruining the Rooster and stuff. It was real weird.
Yeah, so I don't know if he's just getting acclimated or what. But all right, that brings us to our third match of the night. It's a big tag action featuring a debut as the Bolsheviks take on the well-traveled and newly arrived Bushwhackers. Luke Williams and Butch Miller started wrestling as the Kiwis in NWA New Zealand in 1966. Had a great deal of regional success. Working Australia, the Eastern Circuit, booked in North America in Grand Prix, a promotion owned by the Vachon family, Edouard Compatier, in 1972 by a fellow New Zealander, Steve Ricard. In 1973, they went to Montreal. They were there for a while, went to Puerto Rico, worked in Charlotte for Crockett, won the NWA Southeast Tag Team titles in December of 81, worked in Mid-South. I mean, they were just all over the places. The Sheep Herders, of course, was their infamous name. In the AWA, they had a cup of coffee there. Southwest Championship Wrestling, I should say. They were there for a bit. Back to Australia, back to Puerto Rico, hit the AWA again, and then to Crockett again. I mean, they were just all over the place. UWF, everywhere. They clashed with the Fantastics in UWF, lost a New Zealand boot camp match to them when the Fantastics were champions. Went back to Puerto Rico. What else did they do here? Went to NWA Florida. UWF again, having a second run there, and then back to Crockett. They were in the third Jim Crockett Senior Memorial Tag Team Tournament, the cup there. They were at Clash 3. They lost to Steve Williams and Nikita Koloff. Just like, looks like they were about to face the Fantastics in the finals of the tournament to crown new U.S. Tag Champions. They jumped to the WWF, and it's been talked about. I guess we could pause before the match. Do either of you guys have thoughts on the gimmick? Like, it just, I know it's been talked about, like, oh, could they have come in as the Sheep Herders and what that would have been like, but it was never going to happen in 1988 WWF.
I'll let Ryan go first because everyone
knows. Yeah, I mean, I have seen very little of the Sheep Herders. You know, I've seen what was on, like, Jim Crockett Promotions earlier in the year and before that, but I haven't seen a lot to, like, be able to really comment on it, but I just think knowing what WWF was at the time, like, yeah, and they already have Demolition, Powers of Pain. There's really not room for another, like, ass-kicking team. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, they started wrestling in 1966, and I bet between 88 and 92 they made more money being these goofballs than they did 22 years previous. So, more power to them.
Obviously, the Bushwhackers, people have been listening to the show long enough and know my wrestling tastes, and I have issues with the Bushwhackers like I did with Jim Duggan. But the difference between the two is, unlike Duggan, who I never saw his Mid-South stuff and anything because until the network. So when everyone used to tell me, oh, I know you hate him in WWF, and I do too, but he was so good at Mid-South. Well, I never watched it, so all I have is, you know, snot rockets, like Jesse says. I did watch the Sheep Herders because I did have some Crockett and I, my brother had some tapes. So I was even more disappointed because I wanted to see the Sheep Herders. Having said that, I understand that even in 1988 WWF, you're not going to have a tag. I mean, we had enough heels as it is.
Right.
I don't think you're going to have a tag team come in and start ripping barbed wire on guys' faces from their New Zealand. Like, I know, I get that. I get that. But no, it's just unfortunate because they were such a good heel team. But obviously, as I keep saying about work rate and having a more serious roster in ring, you couldn't get rid of all the dopey gimmicks. You needed to keep the kids engaged. So they were a good team to be able to kind of transition that. And maybe the Bushwhacker, maybe Luke and Butch wanted to be funnier. Maybe they
I was
going to
say, they are like here. I mean, Butch is 47 and Luke is 41 when they, or 44, I should say, and 41. So when they got here, like they might've been done. Like I'm done bleeding and, you know, brawling
right.
and cutting each other up. So maybe they were more than happy to just whack,
yeah.
their, you know, whack their arms around, lick some heads, eat yeah, some exactly. sardines and make some money. They missed a window. I think if they would have came in like the late '70s or something, they probably would have been with Albano as like a, you know, kind of a brutal team.
Yeah.
I think
mm-hmm.
More if they come in like in the Attitude Era, you know, like they're probably that way. But in this window here, it just wasn't going to happen. I mean, I guess at some point they
right.
could have maybe done like a heel turn, but I think they were just fine selling hats and selling everything else and just doing the thing and having them as like mascots. You know, like that's what they had, a couple guys as mascots, and they liked having kind of the wild woolly characters. So. I just think that's what they were meant to be at this point, and that's what they are. So here we are. They stomp to the ring to a pop to battle the fading Russians. Rod says this is the debut, and there are a couple of wild guys as they hit the ring and get to work pounding away with strikes and double teams. The Russians clear out. Things continue to break down with all four in there until we finally settle with Butch battering Boris. Rod immediately mixes up the Bushwhackers and starts calling them the wrong one pretty much the whole time.
Yeah,
we go all over the place as things are just coming and going as Al's giggling with excitement. The Whackers bite and claw and stomp away, totally dominating the action. The Russians get glimmer of offense, but they're fleeting when they do. Nikolai eventually shoots Luke to the corner. They take turns beating on him, choking and punching. Excuse me. Butch breaks up a double team and smacks Luke by accident, so Luke comes over and shoves Butch to the floor, and that's a weird spot where they seem, you know, legit angry. The announcers keep talking about how crazy and unpredictable they are, and it's really true. Butch finally gets the tag and unloads. Nikolai ends up outside. Luke comes in. The Whackers get a battering ram, double gut buster on Boris for the win. This is entertaining. It was messy, but it was fine. The Whackers were kind of fun to watch here with their manic offense and insanity. It was all strikes and bullshit, but it was well worked thanks to how different they are. So I'll say this. Like, this incarnation of the Bushwhackers is kind of a little bit of a middle ground between the Sheepherders and what they'd eventually become. Because you're actually getting like this manic energy where they're kind of crazy versus where they're just kind of doing the same shtick over and over. Like, it was kind of fresh here. It didn't feel like the same old Bushwhackers to me. So I went a star and a half. I kind of enjoyed the wildness that they were portraying and the way they were doing stuff, just all over the place doing weird things. And like, I think if this incarnation kind of stayed, maybe they're looked at a little bit differently, but we've had enough Bushwhacker arguments on the Place to Be Nation Network. So we're not going to continue that.
Yes.
What did you think of this match, Scott?
I gave it a star and a half, and actually it was a lot of fun. Again, I think it also, accentuates the fact that the roster is growing, particularly in the tag division. The better teams are obviously elsewhere tonight, except for we have the biggest, the top two teams later on. But this is fine. This was fine. Bushwhackers are entertaining. Nikolai and Boris are what they're supposed to be. So I had no problem with it. The crowd was kind of pumped up. Speaking of the singles version of the Bushwhackers are coming up next. So we're kind of in that same vein now, the mid-show gimmicky stuff. But I don't know, Ryan, I thought it was fine. Star and a half. I mean, but not a offensive star and a half, more like a, all right, I was okay with that. I'm not going to go any higher, but I'm okay with it.
Yeah, I agree. This was not what I was expecting. You know, as you see Bushwhackers versus the Bolsheviks, I was like, oh, Jesus, this is going to be a slog. But no, the Bushwhackers were all over the place. It was mm-hmm. really different seeing them wrestle like this compared to like the Beverly Brothers torture match at the Rumble a couple of years later. I mean, this was pretty entertaining for what it was. And I was kind of confused at the end. Trongert or Lord L calls it an upset. And I mean, if the Bolsheviks ever won a non-squash match,
right?
I don't think, like, I know they never won a pay-per-view match, and I doubt they ever won on Saturday night's main event or anything like that. Maybe when they first got together, they were able to win one match. But, yeah, it was – the Bushwhackers, they had some good energy. Yeah, I liked it. I'd give it 2 stars, actually. I thought it was probably the highest-rated Bushwhackers match I'd ever go. But pretty good.
Yeah, I'm guessing they probably do the upset thing just because they're new. So like they always act like anytime a new team came in, it's like a big adjustment and
new guys from nowhere.
Right, and the Bolsheviks are named team. So yeah, no, it was a nice little debut for the Bushwhackers. Like I could see seeing this at that time and thinking this was going to be like a fun team. We'll see how it goes. Next up, not fun, is the Canadian strongman Dino Bravo taking on Hacksaw Jim Duggan, a rematch from October, but this time the flag match dip is now in place as the war over America continues. Bravo and Frenchie waddle out to booze as they tilt the Quebec flag. Frenchie rambles on like an asshole, and then Duggan storms out with the old glory to a strong ovation. Bravo tries to jump Duggan after some stalling, but Duggan mauls him with clotheslines, slams, and punches until he bails. Bravo returns but gets trapped right away. And Duggan pounds the arm as Rob looks out, lets out a big yo ho is what he yelled out.
Yes.
When he gets him in the thing. I said yoo hoo. Bravo catches Duggan with a boot on a charge and works through his dog shit offense. Frenchie lands a cheap shot from the floor. Bravo keeps mixing up his awkward strikes. Bravo gets an inverted atomic drop and goes to the chin lock as Jim rants on Bravo's actions of late. Alan Rod talk about the Royal Rumble and run through the rules as the crowd tries to rally Duggan. Bravo slugs away, but Duggan comes back with a boot to the gut, punches Dino to the corner. Duggan sets up for a three-point stance, but Frenchie hooks his leg. Duggan swats off Frenchie, but Bravo drills him with a knee for two. Bravo picks up some more close near falls, and a pissed-off Bravo eventually shoves the ref. Frenchie accidentally pelts Bravo with the flagpole, and Duggan covers him for the win and huge pop. Bravo storms off like a bitch as Duggan watches the flag get raised to the rafters, and the national anthem plays. And the crowd chants USA. Fine, thanks to the crowd heat and Duggan's energy, but you can only do so much with Dino. I mean, he's just worthless in there. Hopefully this one's winding down the feud. I would hope. I went one star just for the heat and for Duggan's energy, but God, Bravo is rough. What do you think, Ryan?
Oh, God, yeah. I mean, I don't know what the thing was with Dino Bravo. Like, I guess Patterson just thought that they needed someone from Quebec. Back, but you have the Rougeaus. I mean, he is just horrible. Like, he doesn't even look good. Like, he's just bloated and fat. And oh, geez, this was horrible. I gave it half a star just because Duggan, you know, he was working hard as you could with Bravo, but you know, Bravo's going to get on offense, and then you're going to slow it down all the way. And Frenchie Martin is just horrible. And yeah, That's like the worst act on this show, I thought. Mm-hmm. Duggan and the crowd tried to get something out of it, but you're not getting anything out of Dino Bravo at this point.
Yeah, I gave this half a star. I mean, I wanted to give it a dud, but I couldn't. I mean, it was too. The crowd actually saves this match from being a dud. It's fucking terrible. Dino Bravo is the worst fucking wrestler in the history of the world. And what's sad is. I mean, there's a few, I'm sure, but I mean, when I was watching the All-Star Wrestlings on the network, and I was watching when he was there in like 80, 81, obviously he was considerably smaller and he had some ability, but the minute he fucking bloated up and he's just a mess. He's lazy. Everything is like so slow. He doesn't know how to sell. His histrionics in the ring are just too over the top. And, he's a mess. I mean, he doesn't know psychology. He kind of fumbles around. And
there's really nothing redeeming about him.
There's nothing at all. He doesn't know how to – there's no pacing. He just kind of, you know, fucks around. When you got a guy like Duggan who kind of could use a guy to help him out, it's just a recipe for eye bleeding. It's really what it was. Thank God for the flags and for Frenchie sucking. I always give you grief, JR, that I think you're harsh on Mr. Fuji, but I agree with you 1,000% on how useless Frenchie Martin is. He was a terrible wrestler and he's even worse manager. The whole thing's a mess. And I mean, obviously you knew Duggan was going to win, you know, the holiday house show, people want to go home happy. So you knew Duggan was going to win and that's fine. Unfortunately, I mean, your official match time was mercifully short, 7:26. Thank God. So
not longer than the 20 minute draw.
Yeah. You know, Duggan is crazy over right now. And I'll admit, JR, and maybe I'm curious your guys' thoughts quick. I've been enjoying the Duggan house show matches, except this one, more than the like, remember how we've been talking about Hogan, where like Hogan house show matches are different formula than Hogan national TV matches? I feel like Duggan's the same way. Like Duggan house show matches, like the local stuff where he gets a little time, are better. I don't know if it's just time or he's allowed to have a little more fun, or maybe he actually does have some ability and Vince kind of, you know, neuters it on like Saturday's main event and on pay-per-views. But like, this was fun. It was not great, but it was fun enough with the flags and the crowds pumped and everything. But here's another guy like Hogan, who I feel like is better in a local setting than he is in the national setting in terms of matches. And that's one thing that I've been very surprised about. There's a lot of guys you and I, JR, have been surprised about as we've been watching these that we used to think were fucking the drizzling, and actually not bad in a local setting. You know what I mean?
They get like, some time to play with the crowd, and right. You know, the pacing is a little bit different. They can, you know, they're not tied to the TV construct and everything else, and
right.
They're not on a 15-match bloated pay-per-view card where they only get 3 minutes. Yeah, I mean, yeah, I could see where they get to showcase a little bit more without the kind of tightened rope around them.
I feel like Hogan and Duggan are major examples of that. Sorry, Ryan, go ahead.
Yeah, I was just going to say, though, Hacksaw, the one thing that he did keep with national TV and pay-per-view was while they were raising the flag, he had a big snap that he had to wipe away from his mouth.
Oh, my God.
That was always a problem with Hacksaw. And,
oh, God. God knows Lano's been hidden in that beard. So shall we take a break? What do we got? We're put four matches in. We got let's see,
it's
one
kind of a shortest show, right?
Yeah, we got four matches. We're halfway through. And four. So why don't we take a break? So far. What do you think, JR? Not too bad so far. That last match really has been the only shitter. Not bad so far.
Yeah, just kind of a down the middle show, a usual December fare. I mean, we've had a couple of real December dogs, as the Sheriff Pete will tell you, that he's been slogged through with us. And so on the December scale, this has been real good. You know, it's kind of there right now.
Yeah. What do you think, Ryan?
Yeah, it's been pretty. The first three matches were pretty good. What can you expect from Dino Bravo to slow things down? But yeah, right. First three were good.
Okay. All right, so when we return, we'll do four more matches, including our two title matches, our Tag Team Championships are on the line, and our World Wrestling Federation Championship is on the line, and the start of what would end up being a year-long feud. So stay tuned for that. But first, a break, because...
Promotional consideration paid for by the following.
Place Fee Nation's Justin Rosero and Chad Campbell here. We want to let you know that we have a ton of great podcasts available to you on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, and PlaceFeeNation.com. And we now offer them to you on two great feeds. On the Place Fee Nation Wrestling feed, we bring you the Mothership, the Place to Be podcast, Main Event, Survey Says, Wrestling War Zone, a Monday Night Wars podcast retrospective, No Holds Barred, Jeff Learns Wrestling, and our monthly pay-per-view reaction shows. On top of that, we're also dipping into the vault, re-releasing the entire catalog of Where the Big Boys Play for your enjoyment. And in addition to these full-length shows, we also deliver special network pod blasts on topics old and new.
The Place to Be Nation pop feed is loaded with great content, offering such tremendous shows covering the land of pop culture, such as Geek and Sassy, Talking Pop, the Glenn Butler Podcast Hour Spectacular, Sunday Groove, PTB in Play, Freak Out Drive-In, Songs with Friends, Looking Forward, Looking Back, and Lucha Undead, as well as a veritable podcast heaven for comics fans with the Hard Traveling Fanboys, Sellers Points, Conversation Comics, DC Post Crisis Management, Marvel Age, and Marvel Age Masterclass, plus weekly pod blasts that cover the gamut of comic topics. The feed is also filled with insightful sports content, including the NBA team, This Week in the NFL, and more.
And you can find all these current shows plus archives of our past podcasts, including the Kevin Kelly Show, as well by subscribing to both feeds on iTunes. And while there, be sure to rate and leave feedback as well. All these shows plus others available at PlayStation.com. We cover pro wrestling, sports, movies, comics, in-depth stretch projects, and more. Be sure to support our site by using PlayStation.com/Amazon while doing your online shopping. And download our free PTB Vintage Vault Refresh ebooks via the links on our site. We also want to thank our friends at Boneheads Wing Bar, ProWrestlingOnly.com, and TheHistoryOfWrestling.com. Be sure to follow us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and Tumblr as well. PlayStation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
This is the King of Old School, Steve Carino, the true voice of Ring of Honor, and you're listening to the Place to Be podcast.
We both lie silently still in the dead of the night. On Although we both lie close together, we feel miles apart inside. Was it something I said or something I did? Did my words not come out right? Though I tried not to hurt you, though I tried, but I guess that's why they say every rose has
a... All right, Nation, welcome back. Hope you're enjoying this jaunt through the December 88 MSG House Show, our first show of 2019. And like you said before the break, Scott, it's been a pretty good show, but just that one thorn in the thicket there of what's been a solid output. And of course, every rose has its thorn, and that is the song you're hearing here tonight playing underneath us, because it is time for Scott Criscolo's Pop Culture Corner.
Thank you, JR, and quickie tonight, because we're at the end of the year, so not much going on in a lot of ways. But yes, this was actually the previous, this is a, since this house shows on a Friday night, the 30th, the next day, New Year's Eve, will be a new countdown. But this one goes the previous Saturday, which was actually Christmas Eve. And your number one song is indeed Every Rose Has Its Thorn by Poison. Number two, our boy JR, Bobby Brown, as he broke away from New Edition. He went from his prerogative was no longer Candy Girl. My prerogative at number two. Number three, Look Away by Chicago. And number four, Giving You the Best That I Got by Anita Baker. Number five, Waiting for a Star to Fall by Boy Meets Girl. There's a 80s staple that you'll never, earworm you'll never lose. Yes, it's about Topanga, yes. Number six, Two Hearts by Phil Collins.
Stu Hart.
Number seven, awesome song, incredible song from an incredible album, Welcome to the Jungle by Guns N' Roses from their debut.
Oh, really starting to hit the hair metal, huh? I feel like we haven't had a lot up till this
point. Yeah, it's coming on.
I know. Oh, the next couple of years we're going to get a ton.
Yeah.
Yes, from their debut effort, Appetite for Destruction, arguably one of the greatest debut albums of all time. Welcome to the Jungle at number seven. Number eight, In Your Room by the Bengals. Number nine, Walk on Water by Eddie Money. That's a good one. And at number 10, Don't Rush Me by Taylor Dane. So there's your top 10 from the previous week, Christmas Eve, 1988. Mm-hmm. New countdown will be out the following day. And I think we'll be doing that one on the next show because it's roughly the same week. So Every Rose Has Its Thorn by Poison, your number one song in the country.
I think Ryan was singing that a couple weeks ago. Derrick Rose has his thorn.
Yes. Derrick Rose. Yeah.
It's a 50-point game.
There you go. All right. So no movies, JR. We are done for the year for cinema. So we had some fun. We had some fun movies in 88. Looking forward, 89, we're going to have some good ones. We'll have some good gems. Hopefully we hit the right weeks. As for the NFL, of course, we are in the postseason. The previous weekend, we had our two wild card games. And yes, guys, this was back in the year where the Browns were actually good. But they lost this year. The Oilers beat them. Oh, the Astros could beat them now. The Oilers beat them in the wild card game, 24-23 in Cleveland. And in the NFC wild card game, the Vikings beat the Rams at the Metrodome 28-17. So our divisional playoffs, the fifth-seeded Oilers go to Buffalo to play the Bills, the Seahawks and the number one seed, Cincinnati Bengals, playing in Cincinnati, 49ers hosting Minnesota, and the number one seed, the Bears, taking on the Eagles. And,
God, don't say
that's
that.
Very, you know a game, you know what game that is, Mr. Everett, historic game in the history.
Showed plenty of vignettes of it this past weekend.
Exactly.
Not the same result.
No, it was not. So as we continue on, JR, through the next few shows, we will document the 1988 NFL playoffs. In the NBA on this night, there were 10 games. And you know, actually, JR, whose first season in the National Basketball Association was 1988-89, a team that you would have very near and dear to your heart.
It was the Charlotte Hornets.
Of the Charlotte Hornets. And on this night, they beat the New York Knicks 122-111. You know who was the lead? Tells you how things changed from their awesome years in the early 90s. The leading scorer for the Hornets that night, Kurt Rambis.
Oh, boy.
at 16 points, my boy Kurt Rambis. The high scorer on this evening, was that right?
I said wearing those goggles.
Exactly. That's right. The high scorer on this evening was a tie, a Celtic and a Laker. Shocking. Kareem Abdul-Magic had 34. The Lakers beat the Clippers 124-109. And the Chief, Robert Parrish, he had a double-double, actually. 34 points, 19 rebounds, as the Celtics beat the Spurs 112-99. Ryan, just to let the listeners know, you have an NBA team, correct?
Yes, the Bulls.
Ah, the Bulls. Well, Michael had.
I did have the Bulls, not so much nowadays, but.
Well, you're hitting a good patch here. They're just getting started. Michael had 31 on this night, and the Bulls beat the Pacers 101 to 85.
The four expansion teams, so they didn't all star, right? Was it 2-2, or did they all come in the same year?
2-2. The right. Hornets and the Heat started here.
Yeah.
And then I think the next year, the Timberwolves and the Magic, or right. The year after. No, it was back to back years.
Yeah.
This year it was the Hornets and the Heat. The following year it was the Timberwolves and the Magic. Okay. So, in the National Hockey League on this evening, are you a Blackhawks fan, Trevor?
I am. Yes.
Oh, tough year this year, huh?
Oof. Yeah, things are not good in Chicago sports.
Tough loss for the Blackhawks, for JRs and my Bruins at Notre Dame Stadium. Of course,
yes.
The Bruins looked better than Notre Dame did during the break, but in any event. On this evening in the National Hockey, just three games, JR. Our Whalers beat the Red Wings 4-3, and that's it. No other of our Place to Be podcast teams were in action. And that is it. That is it for a quickie pop culture corner to wrap up 1988. Let us head back to the Garden.
And back to the Garden we go. Sean Mooney's with Rick Rude in backstage. He wants to talks about wanting to show the world how generous he is, but Hibbley messed it all up. He calls Jim a stinking pig farmer and says he shattered that girl's dreams. Rude then challenges Jim to a match at Madison Square Garden. Mooney talks to Powers of Pain and Mr. Fuji, who say they're happy about how things have gone down. The POP have learned the hard way. What will happen if they do something wrong with a bamboo stick to the head? Tonight, anything goes, and Barbarian talks about what Fuji has done to help them, and Fuji says he knows Demolition's weaknesses and will take them down after having got them where they are. That brings us to our next match, featuring Tim Horner taking on Barry Horowitz. It's our first look at old White Lightning, born on August 19, 1959 in Morristown, Tennessee. Horner started wrestling in 1978 in Alabama, signed to Jim Crockett in 84, formed the Lightning Express with Brad Armstrong, won the UWF Tag Team titles in 87, defeating Sting and Rick Steiner. They also won the NWA National Tag Team titles. Horner went on to sign with the WWF in late 88. So I guess just another in like this train of kind of white meat, you know, blowjob baby faces that they've chugged in here. You know, Kaniski and who's the other guy they brought in? There's been like, I feel like he's been three or four Riggins and, you know, like all these Riggins. Like they've been like three or four guys, just one after the other. They've kind of churned into the opening or
two shows and then they're gone.
Yeah, pretty much. Although I think Horner hangs on for a while as kind of a jobber.
Yeah.
He's there at least into 90, I think so. Typical post-intermission match here. Not a lot to get excited about. Horner making his MSG debut against his old friend Barry Horowitz. Our old friend Barry Horowitz, I should say. Barry's hair is looking real rough here. He's got this odd perm going
yeah,
on.
Yeah, really bad.
Al says he's a seasoned campaigner. Hillbilly rips on Rude, says it's time to teach him respect, and he accepts the Ravishing One's challenge. Horowitz works the arm, but it doesn't last long as we settle into a stalemate, sluggish back and forth. Al puts over Rude as a wrestler and gives Jim advice, calls him foolhardy for accepting the challenge. Barry fakes a knee injury to bait Horner into the corner, and then sends him flying with a backdrop and stomps away. Al wonders if Horner's in awe of MSG, and it's causing him not to be able to withstand this offense. Barry gets some rugged offense in, but it's pretty basic. Horner gets two on a sunset flip. Barry goes to the front facelock to get control. Both men wipe out on a double clothesline, and then Horner's up first, unloads some strikes and a snap suplex for two. Horner does a nice flip over Barry as he ducks his head and gets a quick sunset flip for the win. This felt like an exhibition match, like it was fine. Really, it's just a cooler match as the crowd files back in and they let, you know, before we get to the bigger matches. So it's almost just like a second opener at this point, these post-intermission matches. Horner didn't really show much, and Barry's a serviceable. So I gave it a star. I don't see much in White Lightning just yet. We'll see if it goes anywhere between now and his expiration. But at this point, nothing to get too excited about, Scott.
No, I gave it a star as well. I mean, Tim Horner, I mean, this is a guy who – your match time, 8:20. So it was a little more than I thought. I know. I was expecting maybe half that. Tim Horner was a guy who kind of – in fact, I just watched Tim Horner like a couple days ago when I was watching an episode of Mid-Atlantic from fucking 82. So he's definitely been around. It was fine. Barry's hair was looking pretty rough. He may or may not get the Ken Patera Award. It was looking just as fluffy as Patera's would in its prime. So not sure who would get the hair award tonight, but I don't know if Horowitz will. Yeah, that's fine. Nothing to write home about. It was like the first half of the show has been so good. You needed one match, as we call it, the take a dump match. I'm sure the bathroom lines were full, were quite long during this match. That's about it, Ryan. I mean, that's fine for what it was.
yeah, it was just there. I gave it a star also. It was just whatever. Yeah, the only thing these two are competing for is I think both of them have a shot at worst hair because Barry had that perm going on, and Tim Horner, like, I guess he was ahead of the times. He's got the almost a hillbilly Billy Ray Cyrus mullet going on pretty nice, I thought.
He's getting ready to have that achy breaky neck, achy breaky neck, achy breaky legs.
Achy breaky suspenders.
Yeah, white lightning. Nothing going on. All right, next up is something that's going on because it's a big rematch from last month, and that is Demolition taking on the Powers of Pain, and the crowd is all fired up. No DQ rule in place this time as the titles are on the line. Powers of Pain and Fuji get some quality heat as they stomp out for their big shot. Axe and Barbarian get us rolling as Rod pushes the Rumble with a hard sell. Axe lands a clothesline and tags Smash as it clubs away at the big man. Rod tells us that John Studd is returning at the Royal Rumble and also lists a bunch of other participants in all of the undercard matches. Warlord gets a tag and hammers away, but puts his head down and gets cracked and then double-teamed. Axe clubs away, but Warlord escapes and tags Barbarian, who starts to choke and lay in some strikes. Al puts over Fuji's stewardship and success in the tag ranks. Fuji smacks Smash with the cane as Powers of Pain can take turns battering Axe. Axe cracks Warlord and tries to tag Smash, who's still down. Barbarian hits a running shoulder for two and follows with a hard shoulder breaker as Fuji's causing all sorts of trouble. Axe barely dodges a Warlord headbutt off the top and makes a tag. Smash comes in hot, knifes through both challengers, and then things completely break down as all four are around ringside, but Warlord sneaks in and the champs get counted out. Demolition clears the ring after. Another fun power brawl with these teams. Lots of heavy offense, a chaotic flow, quick pacing, not much slowing down given who's involved, and the crowd is into it. This has been a pretty good feud that looks to have more in the tank. I think it's better than remembered at this point. And Powers of Pain, the heel turn has worked for them. Demolition, the face turn has, you know, worked for them. I think everything's kind of settled in nicely. I went 2.5 on this one, Ryan.
Yeah, I went 2. I thought it was okay, but, and again, I know this is 88 WWF, so I'm not expecting like an ECW style tag brawl, but I just don't like no DQ tag matches where people tag in and out the whole match. Like, at least go at it, you know, tornado rules or something, and then send on a count out. Like, I know why they did it, but it just felt kind of cheap, and again makes Fuji look like an idiot because he's the guy who comes in and hits Smash with his cane.
He is an idiot. Hot take
there. And Smash rolls out of the ring, and that's the end of the match. He doesn't get one of his big 300-pound guys to put their opponent back in the ring. I don't know. I just, the count out and in the no DQ match is kind of like, I thought maybe they should have done Demolition can lose by DQ and then do a count out. I mean, I guess it'd be the same.
Well, yeah, no, they could have done Demolition can, yeah, maybe lose the titles if they lose by count. Yeah, something like that. Or they should have, I don't know. Yeah, I don't know what they could have just done, like, a not a DQ, but like a no contest, like things just break down, yeah, they beat the refs up or something like that.
Beat off the refs. Yeah, that would maybe be a little better.
What do you think?
Yeah, I gave this match I gave it 2 stars. Little less than you, JR. I liked it. Your match time 6:55. So at least they realize that you're not going to give you can't give these guys much more than that. Fun brawl. The Fuji thing at the end made no fucking sense at all. Like he's taking all the logic out of this feud. Everything he's done has actually helped Demolition since the turn at Survivor Series. So I kind of feel bad for the Barbarian, the Warlord, because nothing makes any sense here. He's blowing their chances to actually be the champions. So it logically just made no sense whatsoever.
Yeah, he gave up the championship belt and now is costing his new team the shot winning them. So
the chance to win it. Like, it's totally absolute nonsense.
Well, he's having said that, to be devious, I mean, that's a big undertaking.
It is, yeah. You know, there's no Mr. Saito's here or Toru Tanaka's who know it naturally. I like the Warlord of the Barbarian. I love both these teams. You know, JR and I are big fans of, you know, Haas tag teams, and you're not going to get more Haas than these two, except maybe the Twin Towers. But I feel like I'm glad that we're seeing different subdivisions of the tag division. Mm. We had like kind of the lower jobber comedy teams earlier. These are the two big power Haas teams, the show in Chicago, or in Columbus, was it Columbus? In Columbus had the two kind of the worky teams, Brainbusters, Rockers. So even the subdivisions within the tag division, you're seeing different styles, which is fantastic. And I think that's one of the main reasons, and obviously we'll expound on this throughout the next throughout 1989, is that this tag division is just well-rounded in its ability to entertain and its ability in the ring. Power guys, comedy teams, we're great teams. It's exciting, and this was a lot of fun. Sans Fuji's being a fucking idiot, so. I think the Powers of Pain have actually saved Demolition a little bit, because we've talked about this, JR, that from WrestleMania 4 till probably Survivor Series, they've been fine, but not great. I mean, they've beat up like some you know, the Bulldogs, and mm-hmm. who were already kind of cooked anyway. But we felt like they weren't quite there. And it wasn't that they should have been faces but were heels. That has nothing to do with it. They just didn't feel like they were there as the top team in the division, because the division, and through no fault of their own partially, the division was in a state of flux. But now that we're kind of seeing a hierarchy now, Demolition is now being spotlighted, and they're looking a lot better. So I think ultimately, yes, the face turn probably helped them, because there's a ton of awesome heel teams right now. Whereas when they were heels, there really wasn't a wealth of face teams. You had Bulldogs. You had the Hart Foundation, and that was kind of it. I guess the Bees, but they were pretty flat by that point anyway. Now that they're the faces, now we've got this abundance of great heel teams that will make Demolition, that will help Demolition shine. And I think the Powers of Pain are one of those teams. So I love this match. The Fuji stuff kind of knocked it off for me a bit, but great things to come from this tag division.
Mm-hmm.
The different styles, the different kinds of teams. Very, very exciting.
It's very deep and very loaded for sure.
Yeah, so good match.
All right. Interesting match up next, as another arrival. We've seen a ton of new faces here over the last couple of months and tonight. And that is Rugged Ronnie Garvin makes his arrival into the WWF. Roger Barnes, born March 30th, 1945 in Montreal, Quebec, Canada. Barnes started wrestling in 1962, even before the fucking Bushwhackers, under his birth name. Mid-60s, adopted the ring name Ron Garvin, formed a team with Terry Garvin. Of course, he runs the School of Self-Defense. They teamed throughout the late 60s and early 70s, won some regional tag titles, worked in Angelo Poffo's ICW, and much like the Bushwhackers and many others around this time, worked the circuit, went to NWA Georgia, went to Crockett. And, of course, he had a very successful run in Crockett where, you know, they're – it looked like he was potentially, you know, they talked about this on the where the Big Boys play from the vault a lot in 86, I should say. Looked like maybe he was being prepped for a feud with Flair toward the end of that year into Starrcade. That gets put on hold. He ends up being the guy to beat Flair for the world title in September of 87, and then loses it back at Starrcade 87. I think, you know, a guy that's overlooked often when you think about just how good he was overall. His punches were so good. His as a wrestler, he's so good. Drew a lot of great heat from, you know, from a face point of view. Got a lot of good pops. Just a real credible guy. And, you know, Scott, I know, like, in our original kind of trip through these, he's a guy that we would, you know, kind of bag on a bit. But he, I mean, he's really on his back end when he reaches here. You know, he's like 43, 44. But he can still go, as we'll see here and there. But I think his WCW or his NWA run is one that is oft overlooked for just how good it is. And I think shows like where the Big Boys play and others that have kind of opened more of a spotlight onto the work he was doing in 86, 87, 88 in the NWA has helped a lot. I think he's a guy that definitely was overlooked for many years.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I wasn't a huge Garvin fan. Chad and I have always debated each other about it. I don't know why. I hated his promos. That was one debate that I used to get into. I think you, Chad, there's a couple other people that, like, I just couldn't stand. He mumbled his words. He just was never coherent. I don't know. I never really disliked him in the ring. I thought he was fine in the ring. I thought he was a good baby face. He had a great feud in Georgia with Jake over the TV title. Obviously he had the lucky run with Flair when he actually won the world title.
Yeah, it was kind of like no one really wanted to be the lame duck, right? 3 month champion, yeah, but he's like, fuck it, I'm 42. Like, that's probably it.
Exactly.
Yeah, so he took it.
I'll always be, yeah, exactly.
But he had other fun stuff too, like the, you know, the stuff with Bubba Rogers, and of course he mm-hmm. was teamed with Jimmy Garvin, involved with the Jimmy Valiant stuff. You know, he had like a lot of cool stuff going on during this time.
And him and Wyndham teamed against the Lights in a great match that's on the network. Like mm-hmm. early 87. It's like a 30-minute match. It's awesome.
What is it again, Ryan? What were the two teams?
It's him and Wyndham versus the Midnights.
Oh, okay.
I think it's the U.S. tag titles. It's early 87. I'm not sure the exact date, but it's worth a look.
Yeah, and he actually had he turned heel in early 88. He turned on Dusty. He took money from Cornette or some shit like that. So he got to do. You're getting to this point now where a lot of these guys that are in their 40s are like, you know what? Vince is going to offer some checks. I'm sure the day to day grind probably sucks, but I'll get paid well and I'll be on big pay per view. So fuck it. Might as well go now. So smart business move by Garvin to mm-hmm. come here. And his first opponent is a doozy.
Oh, yeah. It is Greg the Hammer Valentine. Very interesting power match. Hammer's been a bit aimless in 88. Just yes. kind of going match to match, mini feud to mini feud. Yep. Kind of had that blip with Morocco. And Billy Graham had his little kind of thing with Beefcake, but not too much going on from a meat perspective. Jim gushes over Rockin' Robin. As Al says, Judy Martin is a beautiful woman. It's odd. Of course, they're talking about
yes.
the Royal Rumble.
Yeah.
Rod then talks about Jimmy the Hitman Hart, who's usually in Greg's corner, but is absent tonight. That made me laugh. The two bulls lock up as Al goes back to debating the ladies, saying Robin is too skinny. He's surprised she appeals to a guy like Jim. Jim says he loves watching her wrestle and she'll easily beat Judy Martin at Royal Rumble. Al says Robin was lucky to even win the title. So Sherry is probably homesick while traveling in Paris, and that aided to the loss. This is like way off the fucking field here. Garvin and Hammer trade some basic offense as they keep filling each other out. Hammer catches Garvin, works the arm as the commentary solely focused on the Rumble now. Garvin chops out of an arm bar and lays in some vicious chops in the corner to send Greg out to regroup. Hammer turns the tide, drops some hard elbows, but Garvin comes right back with wild punches and chops, just really rattling the Hammer, who's out on his feet. Garvin twists into a sleeper and rides him to the mat before releasing and cracking Hammer with a hard headbutt. Hammer survives and battles back as the two get into a test of strength on the mat. That goes to the standing position. Garvin lays in three hard headbutts and even more loaded chops. Now Hammer comes back with some brutal strikes, just drops Garvin with a forearm. The two end up toe-to-toe and just battering each other like punch-drunk boxers as the crowd is all fired up. Garvin takes Hammer down and works his whole body with the Garvin stomp. Hammer reverses a whip and gets a sleeper, but Garvin runs to the corner, leveraging Hammer to the buckle to break. Hammer gets a shin breaker, works the midsection before loading up the shin guard in figure four. Garvin blocks out a small package for two. Hammer quickly regains control with more chops. Garvin blocks another figure four with a great right hand, goes to a side headlock, and then before decking him, Garvin's limping around and gets a near fall. Garvin rips off the shin guard, but the ref blocks him from using it, and Hammer rolls him up for the win while he's distracted. Garvin then beats on Hammer with the shin guard after. This is a fucking war. Great match with some of the best strikes and hardest shots you'll see. Garvin comes in red hot to the WWF with this match. Hammer got something juicy to work with. Just fight forever. You want to give me that chance? This is these guys right here, just tailor-made for each other. Just beating the piss out of each other with no fucking concern for their bodies. And it got the crowd into it. I love this. I went 3.5. And I think this is a real hidden gem on this card. Everyone knows the Rumble match, but this one's kind of buried in there. This was a ton of fun. Scott, what do you think?
Well, if you remember, JR, I gave this match 11 stars when yes. I did the first review. So I'm giving this one 37. No, I'm only kidding. I gave it 4 stars, actually. This match was awesome for a few reasons. Number one, this was a perfect first opponent for Garvin. I'm sure they've got some history. They both have that kind of southern roots. They both worked in Georgia, both worked in the Carolinas. So they're very snug. And, I mean, this was just a fun back and forth. I mean, I don't think you could have found two better guys to put into a 17. By the way, the length of this match, 17:09. They were given a ton of time. Yeah.
17 and I think glorious minutes.
Yeah. I mean, it was they were just hitting the shit out of each other. And I think that Garvin was probably like, you know, listen, Hammer and I have worked together before. let's get a good fun setup match for the main event, and let's get the crowd all riled up and ready to go. And I mean, they were just smacking each other. I mean, those chops were reverberating off the ceiling. They were so heavy. And the Rumble match had that funky stip and everything. So as great as that match was, this one didn't have any of that. They were just able to go kind of free flowing. Valentine didn't have he had the shin guard, but he didn't name it yet and all that kind of stuff. I think this was a very Southern match. This could have been a match at like a Clash or at a Starcade or a Bash or something, because it had that feel, just two guys just beating the fucking tar out of each other. And you really could have, very un-MSG-ish, very un-WWF type. And I don't know if Vince was crazy about that or not, but hey, you know what? It was tremendous, Ryan. But yeah, very Southern, where they were very snug. And you didn't have a lot of histrionics. They just instead of staring at each other and looking at the crowd like usual WWF heels do, they just hit each other. And I think that thinking, which you normally don't see in a match like this in the WWF at this time, made it shine and stand out even more.
Yeah, I agree. I love this match. And, you know, as you were saying, it's not like what you saw usually. And this was Garvin's MSG debut, right?
Yes, first time ever here. Ever.
And, I mean, the crowd, by the end of the match, they're all about it. So even though, you know, like you were saying, Vince wasn't used to it, well, he was probably okay with it by the end because the crowd was going crazy towards the end for a new guy who, you know, not very cartoony, you know, not like the Bushwhackers. He didn't have, you know, a prime time dedicated to Mean Gene searching for him or whatever. However, they brought the Bushwhackers in. You know, this guy is just, there's this tough guy who walks around with a towel around his neck who is just going to beat the hell out of Greg the Hammer Valentine. And, you know, growing up, I was always, you know, I came up around like 1990 as a fan, so I never saw Garvin like live. And going back basically all 89, all of his pay-per-views, he's, you know, the ring announcer and the guest interviewer just screwing with the Hammer, but this showed him in a whole different light, and it was something. It was, I gave it 4 stars also. I thought it was an awesome match. It was a lot like it reminded me a lot of the Piper Valentine match that they put up on the network earlier this year.
Oh, yes, yes. Not the Starcade 83, the one earlier in the year.
Right,
yeah,
the one earlier in the year. It was like that. I mean, it's just two guys just beating the shit out of each other. It was awesome.
JR, if you haven't watched that match, highly recommend it. It's just like this one. I mean, they're just laying it. And that's why. See, thank you, Ryan. You helped. You backed up the point. They wrestled it like a Southern match. It was snug and stiff. Really good. Really good. Yeah, good call, Ryan. Highly recommend that match, everyone. It's on Is it in the Gems? I think it's in the Gems.
Yeah, it's in the Gems.
In 83. It's the same year as the Dog Collar. Yeah, it's like June or July of 83. No commentary, so if you're one of those ones that hate non-announcers, you might have to squirm your way through it. But
I usually am one of those, but this match, it's one of those matches where you watch and you get drawn into it without that even. Yeah.
Now, if you haven't seen it, JR, I highly recommend it. Mm-hmm. It's just as good as this one. Very good.
All right. So, if you can find this one, check it out because it's a lot of fun. Well worth your time. All right. Finn comes out, wishes everyone a happy new year, runs down the card for next month, and then that brings us to our main event of the night. World title on the line as Macho Man Randy Savage takes on Bad News Brown. Brown's been chasing the champ down, berating Jack Tunney, and like you said, hinting that Elizabeth's been blowing him to keep him away. Savage gets some new blood to work with as well, which is nice. We've pretty much spent all of 88 with DiBiase and Andre, so it's nice to see him with someone new. Brown's focused and pacing as Savage and Liz march out to a big pop, looking great as always. Savage attacks Bad News at the bell before even disrobing, just beating him all around the ring and chucking him over the top. Savage follows out and spikes Bad News to the announce table as Al reminds us that Brown has said some nasty stuff about Liz and Savage lately. Back inside, Macho hits an axe off the top and just keeps battering Brown from corner to corner. Bad News catches Savage with a shot in the corner, slings the champ to the floor. Bad News slugs away outside, and then back inside, Brown spikes Savage across the top rope before starting to work the neck. Broad says Brown is clubbering and is a mean man as Brown lays in headbutts. So maybe Dusty was watching the show. That's where he got it from. Al says Liz is a detriment to Savage's career as Brown keeps in control, really laying it in. Brown takes the fight back outside and then socks Liz until the refs get in the way. Savage is able to shove Brown into the post to buy a breath. Rod says Brown is the king of the streets, a street barbarian. Savage smacks Brown around but gets caught with his head down. Brown gets twisted up. Savage knocks him outside and leaps off the apron, dives into him in a great spot. Savage gets cracked with a headbutt outside, but he blocks a pile driver and backdrops Brown instead. Savage slides in and goes up top, but he pelts Brown with an axe. Savage pulls Brown up and suplexes him into the ring for a close near fall. Savage goes up, but Brown catches him with a shot to the gut as he leaps off and gets back to work with strikes and a Russian leg sweep for two. Savage knocks Bad News down and goes to the big elbow, but Bad News dodges it to stay alive. Brown slugs away, slams Savage. Savage rolls through the small package and seals the win to a big pop. Savage smashes Brown from behind and knocks him to the floor and celebrates for a minute. And then Brown comes in with a full trash can and just levels Savage with it.
Mm.
The refs help deter Brown and Savage fends him off. A fun finish, a good fast-paced, rugged battle. Matches like this really help pad Savage's resume as champion too. Just like the variants and opponents and the different kinds of styles. Brown looks good as well. Worked hard, mixing things up. And Savage is as great as always. The crowd is into it. And it's a nice title defense by Savage. I dug it. I liked it a lot. I went 3 stars. The brawling aspect was good, and I liked Savage just sneaking out that win. I was really glad, because I know Brown's one that doesn't usually lay down, so I was like fearing another DQ or count out bullshit here, so I was glad that Savage got the pin, because he's got big things coming in 89. Brown's been a nice little, you know, pause for him, and I think it continues a bit, but I thought it was pretty good. So 3 stars, Ryan.
Yeah, I went 3 stars also. I was another one I thought, you know, Savage really, I mean, obviously he's always wrestled with energy, but it's even like, even was, you know, kind of back to that heel meanness that he had, and it was, you know, kind of playing off the storyline of you don't screw with Elizabeth, and that obviously helps set the stage for what comes later, you know, in a couple months, to just show that you don't mess with Elizabeth one way or the other. And he was really aggressive to start the match up. That was really nice to see. It wasn't like, you know, your typical face gets the shine, then the heel comes back. It was pretty much Savage was in control for most of the match till the end there. And then I liked Savage, you know, not winning with the elbow, so he kind of has to sneak it out. And I know, I don't think they come back to the Garden, but they did another tour, like the no DQ matches that I've seen, a few like street fights, which kind of, they kind of set the stage for that here, but I don't think they went back to the Garden with it. But yeah, I thought it was a really good match. Nice to see Savage get a win, but not so strong that like you can't say, oh, Brown could have beat him.
Yeah, no, I agree. I give this 3.5. What an end to the show. I mean, the last like 45 minutes or maybe half hour of this show might be some of the best stuff we've watched all year. Your match time... 9:54. So they probably got a little criminally short, but still, so much fun. Savage, it's a shame. Because not that Savage's reign has been bad, but again, he got caught kind of in the Andre slog, and not in the slog, but he had to deal with him and DiBiase a lot over the summer. So a lot of his title defenses were just them. Now we're starting to see a little variety, but you know, obviously we're getting a big turn as we turn the calendar. But Savage will always be one of the smartest, business guys when it came to being champion and how to handle yourself psychologically in certain situations. And Bad News just got, I mean, look, he pretty much told you your wife's a whore. So, I mean, you know, you shouldn't be walking out, and you, JR, you and I have commented on other matches where, you know, there should be a major blood feud, and instead they're just kind of, you know, collar and elbow tie up, instead of like gouging his eyes out. Savage's like, fuck that shit. You pretty much called my manager slash whatever girlfriend, wife. I mean, they never really alluded to that, but you call my manager a slut. you know, so Savage just got it. And I think, this title reign, which is probably one of the best, in history, because he understood how to get all these heels going and how to get crowds riled up. He was very different than Hogan in that aspect. Hogan got the crowd riled up in another way, comebacks, where Savage was very aggressive. And when he had the right opponent who had no problem, you know, working back that way with him, you get a classic match. And that's what this match is. Had there been more pay-per-views, if this was the future and you had monthly pay-per-views, I mean, I could have seen this end with a Hell in a Cell or a really great cage. This could have been a multi-month feud that really could have percolated for a while.
I think they should have started it earlier, you know?
I think so, too.
If they started in the fall, maybe you skip the Andre piece. Well, I mean, those Andre matches are good, too. I don't know. You know, I don't know. I'm trying to think of where they could. It's just tough because with 89 coming, there's not much more room for it. So, yeah.
Yeah, it's really packed in 89, I know. And even there's a few matches after the turn where I think they still run them. But so Bad News Brown's kind of like a de facto face.
They should have had Bad News in the Survivor Series match. Like, this crap on that team. like he could have been in there instead of the Rooster. You know what I mean? Like, and then maybe you could have started a little bit earlier and you get him in there.
Right. Yeah. But it was just so good. Two guys who were just good at just you know, laying it all out there and throwing their bodies all over the place. And it's just so great. So great. What a last, like, 40 minutes of this show. Just so good. Yeah, I was very impressed. Good end of the show. What a great way to end the year. You're right, JR. Normally we get the Sheriff Schirmacher stinker.
Yeah. But no, this is a rare, really good December show. Yeah.
But a great December show. So good way to end it. Good way to end the show. A lot of fun.
Yeah, and then Rod, Jim, and Al wrap us up. So, all right, why don't we get to our awards to bring this thing to a close. So we will start with our match of the night, and to me that's an easy call tonight, and that is unexpectedly Ron Garvin versus Greg Valentine.
Yeah, the match is amazing. Honorable mention to any of the last three matches have been fine.
Yeah, we finished strong.
In their own special way. But I'll go with definitely with Garvin and Valentine. Ryan.
Yeah, I totally agree. It was... You know, the main event was really good, but most months probably would have taken it. But Ronnie Garvin coming up big in his MSG debut.
All right, for the Cousin Jr., the worst of the night, I went Tim Horner and Barry Horowitz for this one. And even that wasn't terrible, but to me it was just the worst that we watched.
Oh, God.
I had it worse than Duggan. Yeah, I know. I had it worse than Duggan because of the heat.
Yeah, I don't know. What do you think, Ryan? I'll let you.
Sorry, Hacks. I got to give it to Duggan.
Oh, God, they were both awful. fuck. You know what I'm gonna do? I'm gonna put. All right, because I'll split the difference. I'm gonna do the Horowitz Horner match because it wasn't that great. But that match, the Bravo match, is gonna go to another award. So, okay. All right, yeah. I'll go with
our Andre the Giant award for the MVP of the night. I went with Savage. I thought he was. I mean, it was tough, but I feel like I gave Garvin the other one. So I'll give Savage some love here. I thought he was great in that main event and the post match and everything else.
I give it to Savage too. He's not world champion by accident.
Yeah, Savage. It. You can see. I mean, there's a reason why he's. I mean, he's headlining Madison Square Garden while Hogan. You know, is out in Chicago. There's a reason they got Savage on top.
Three of the last four MVPs have gone, well, two and a half, I guess. Savage split at Survivor Series, but not by accident. Yeah.
All right. The Sandy Beach Award for the worst work of the night here. Dino Bravo can reign supreme for me.
Yep. That's why I'm all right splitting the difference and putting Horowitz and Torner as the worst match, because Dino Bravo is just the most useless human being on the fucking entire roster. He's absolutely terrible. He does nothing right. His manager sucks. It's just a mess.
Yeah, I'm giving it to Bravo, no doubt. Just clean sweep for all the worst awards for him.
All right, best moment. I went with the Garvin and Hammer slugfest late in that match where they're just like beating the shit out of each other down the stretch.
Yeah. I mean, there were a lot of good moments in the last, like, hour of this show, but, yeah, just seeing the two of them just literally hit each other as hard as they possibly can was absolutely tremendous.
Yeah, I agree that. When they're beating the shit out of each other and Garvin grabs the shin guard and is trying to use that, yeah, that was awesome.
All right, the Morocco Award for the biggest juice head of the night, I went with Dino Bravo here.
Yep, and that's why he's fucking terrible.
I went with Warlord, actually, because at least it looked good on him, I thought. And he was, like, really flexing when they were doing their promo backstage. So and, you know, at least he knows how to use it so that you don't have a huge gut. So I went Warlord.
Yep.
All right. All right. The Patera Award for the worst hair, I went with Horowitz and his stupid perm.
Yeah, it was bad. It looked like a helmet. It really did. Like earlier in the year when Hogan had that, it's on the network. There's a LA house show from earlier this year, and he had like the fucking USC Trojan thing on. that looked smaller than Horowitz's hair. Literally looked like an action figure head. It was ridiculous.
Yeah, I don't know if Horowitz went to a salon on the Lower East Side or something since it was in New York. But, you know, no, yeah, that was horrible.
All right, and finally, our overall grade. You know, I thought this was a really good show, one of our better MSGs we've seen. Not too many, like, we didn't really have stinkers. We had a couple matches that, you know, that weren't great, but I don't think anything that was like, oh, my God, a stink bomb that we needed to get away from. Even when you get an opener that's good, like, that's a nice start. And then we had a 3.5-star match, a 3-star match. We had the Demolition Powers of Pain. That Perfect Coco was good. So, like, I thought this was a really good show. It chugged along. You know, even the Rude Hibbley stuff was kept pretty short during that segment, so... I went 6.5 on this one, which is one of the better grades for MSG for me.
I may be overgrading this a bit, but that's fine. This show was really good. Even the announcing was not as bad as it was not bad, even without Billy Graham. Every match had some kind of meaning. Didn't have to be great. I mean, at least Doug and Bravo was, you know, continuing and hopefully finishing a feud. Yeah. As bad as it was. I'm giving this an 8.
Wow.
I'm giving it 8 out of 10. This show was great. I could watch this show again anytime. I don't say that about many MSG house shows. This show was a lot of fun. The last three matches, the tag title match, Garvin and Valentine, and the Savage Bad News Brown might be the best threefer to end a house show that we've ever seen. Absolutely amazing. I give it an 8.
Yeah, I'll come close to splitting the difference. I went 7. I just thought, yeah, it was, you know, going through what some of the MSG shows you guys have gone through, I was not expecting a lot getting into this. But, yeah, this was an easy watch. It was just about 2 hours, 15 minutes. And, yeah, really only 2 or 3 matches that dragged. Everything else was boom, boom, boom. Yeah, I thought it was really good, especially for a house show.
And I think looking ahead, JR, as we look ahead to 89, I think this won't be the last time we get a stacked house show. I think we're going to be pleasantly surprised we go through 89 how good the house shows are going to be.
Yeah, well, we'll see. It'll be a deep roster for sure. So, all right. So that'll do it for the year of 1988. Been a very interesting year. Maybe next episode, Scott, we'll kind of put a bow on 88 as a whole as we enter 89, since it's a Saturday's main event. We'll have a little bit more time to breathe. So we'll talk about that. But looking forward to that. It'll be in 2 weeks' time. We'll be here talking about the 179 Saturday's main event. I believe Peter Winston should be with us then, as usual for those. I will direct everyone over to the bigelow34.proboards.com message board. We have a lot of great discussion daily as that has rebooted up, and it's really taken off a lot more than I expected. I thought it'd be a lot slower going in the beginning.
I know.
So I am thankful for everyone who's really taken part and jumped back in there. We're going to be doing our yearly pay-per-view pick'em in there starting up soon. So if you're interested in that, come over to the board and sign up. Also, our year that was 1996 project has kicked off. We have the watch list up for January 96. It is going to be jam-packed with a lot of cool stuff. We're pulling stuff not only from the network, but also other sources and B and C shows and everything else. So all you got to do is watch what's on the list on your own time and then put some comments in the thread, and then we're going to have some categories once we finish the year. So that's a lot of fun. What's that, Ryan?
I started plowing through the playlist today. It was pretty good stuff.
Yeah, there's some fun stuff. It's both the best and the worst. So there's a lot of good stuff in there to watch.
There's some more for sure.
And we got some more on the way. We're pulling some cool things in from a couple sources that it can be like stuff from like forgotten. Like there's one that we just found that's like a Benoit Eddie match from Saturday Night. You know what I mean? Like it's stuff that we probably just haven't seen maybe at all or in forever. So some neat stuff is going to be on the list to watch, and we're linking what we can. So Check that out as well. In the world of new audio, we had a brand new Wrestling War Zone back from our hiatus, looking at the 11-2095 Raw and Nitro. It's a night after Survivor Series, of course, of the infamous Owen Hart Shawn Michaels match and a all-time classic Diesel promo. Also, we'll point you to No Holds Barred that dropped on New Year's Eve. Aaron George and I did a live watch of the movie New Year's Eve and talked about a lot of other nonsense along the way. Check that out. And I will be on the newest edition on the PTV and Pop feed of The Great Debate with Andy Atherton. So be on the lookout for that this week, too. So very busy boy in the past couple weeks. Scott, what do you got going on?
We have a fresh, brand new and clearly news-filled main event this week. Of course, plenty of stuff going on this week in wrestling. Busy day today. But we will be, myself, Nate, and Mr. Willie will be wrapping up 2018. We'll talk about what things were, matches, news, and obviously look ahead. And obviously we'll talk a lot about All Elite and what happened today. So a jam-packed main event that'll be later. It'll probably drop early Friday morning like it usually does. But we'll recap 1988. We'll recap 2018 with a lot of great stuff and look ahead to 2019, of course, beginning with this brand new promotion that is no joke, apparently. So stay tuned for that later in the week.
All right. Ryan, anything you want to plug or anything you got going on you want to talk about?
No, just Bears, please cut Cody Parkey.
Okay, there you go. All right, so everyone, thank you for your support as we start another new year here. Always lots going on, and I should also mention the results from the GWE Tag Team balloting will be out as well soon. So be sure to peep that, and we'll also close out by announcing the winner of the PTBN Christmas Episode Extravaganza Contest. It was one man who actually was able to – took up three listens, he said. But he got everyone that participated in that play, and that was Callum McDougall. So he will be joining us for a future episode either of Place to Be or Main Event. We'll let him choose that, and we'll get on that soon. So thank you to everyone. Subscribe to our feeds, PlayStation Wrestling, PlayStation Pop, and PlayStation.com, Twitter, Place2BNation, and Facebook.com/PlaceToBNation as well. So, for Ryan and Scott, I'm Justin. We're out. We'll talk to you in 2 weeks' time. Everyone, take care.
Maybe there needed to be fog in Chicago, Ryan, and maybe he would have kicked it right.
Maybe it was in for a rude awakening, like Rick Rude wanted to give.
It's not a good-looking lady, either, that he really brought in.
It wasn't a good-looking kick, either.
No. No, not at all. I don't think the black girl is ready.
Don't say it.
In any event, Hillbilly Jim doesn't have much in common with you, Jesse.
Wait just a minute. You told me this was a rock and roll album. That's why I participated in it. What's Hillbilly Jim got to do with rock and roll?
Wait a minute, Jesse. I think it's important you have a little soul, even though it be a country soul.
And perhaps you best take heed of the title of this next cut by Hillbilly Jim. Don't go messing with a country boy.